It's time to welcome in David Tarachuk and, of course, the Media Beat. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Reporting in for you from the media capital of the world, New York City.
And how upsetting, embarrassing, unbelievable is it that we sit here today with the jury and the Floyd murder trial going into their deliberations. Now, we find out this morning that a 13-year-old was shot with his hands in the air after the police claimed he had a gun. Last night, Indianapolis had a mass shooting, 8 people dead. This country and guns, and this is just an unbelievable sequence of events, David.
It's a heart-sinking day, you know, like many, many heart-sinking days we've had in recent times. You can't help the feeling that the rate of these distressing incidents is going up, because each one just seems to be another terrible sucker punch to the consciousness of this country. In Indianapolis, yes, the killing of 8 people at a FedEx depot, and the shooter evidently killing himself, but coming hard on the heels of 2 other major American cities, reeling the trial in the killing of George Floyd, coming to its final stages, and the first appearance in court of a police officer charged with shooting Dante Wright, a 19-year-old, as you say, and then in Chicago, the killing of a 13-year-old, Adam Toledo, and it's to see the press reaction has been intriguing, in some ways really distressing. It's hard to resist a kind of hysteria sometimes, but part of the job of the media in general, and that includes the hometown newspapers of communities that are afflicted by these terrible things, is to hold the line for sanity and sense and common sense. I'm afraid in Chicago, I have to put a big black mark against coverage there. The Tribune group of newspapers, in a way, I've had something of a not exactly a soft spot, but certainly a sort of grateful connection with the Tribune newspapers. We wouldn't have this slot, the Media Beat, every week if it wasn't for the Tribune newspapers beginning the Media Beat in a New York daily newspaper that they used to own. We owe the company for that, although the company has changed hands several times since then. But the Chicago Tribune, which is at the heart of the Tribune newspaper group traditionally, did some coverage of the Adam Toledo case, which is shocking. An opinion piece carried very early on, absurdly early on, in fact, trying to argue that here is a phrase that will make any journalist stop and catch his or her breath, I think. The argument of this opinion piece was urging us all to stop romanticizing and infantilizing 13-year-olds, and proceeded to make a list of 5 instances in the last year of 13-year-olds who are charged with killings, with a complete blithe disregard for common decency as well as common sense, in the way that it was so prejudicial to the matter of Adam Toledo, who is a 13-year-old and of course is not in any way at all charged with anything remotely approaching killing anyone. And in fact, as you say, the police video released shows very clearly that if he had been carrying a gun before, he had dropped it at the moment that he was told to show his hands. He showed his hands, lifted his hands, and the video very clearly shows him being shot a second later. journalism's not been distinguishing itself this week in Chicago. The whole case, of course, carries echoes for Chicago and for the rest of us, of course, of the killing of Laquan McDonald, who's 17, back in 2014, killed by a Chicago police officer there, who was charged with first-degree murder and found guilty and sentenced to 6 years plus. And in that case, it's intriguing to notice that one very big difference. It took over a year for the video to emerge in the Laquan McDonald case. In the case of Adam Toledo, thankfully, although it's a horrible thing to see, the video has been made available within a couple of weeks. And we can all see, the public can see and make their own judgment about the police claims. The early claims were inaccurate, it seems. It is made pretty clear by the video. And we have another case of a white police officer killing a minority member of a young age, this case extraordinarily young, and we have, as a result, not one but two cities desperately on edge with fury about these appalling events.
And I just don't understand how people who are white that don't understand what it would be like to be riding in a car or driving a car, being a black American, and having those cruiser lights go off behind you. I'm sorry. There is a reason there's Black Lives Matter. There is a reason why it's just you look at the facts that have laid before us, and now especially in this past week, you look at the facts that lay before us, and if you're a black American, I'm sorry, you have every right to be nervous about being pulled over, about being asked to step out of the car, about being at your own, inside your own home. It's something, there has to be a line that has to be crossed here, that has to be somehow fixed.
It's extraordinarily distressing evidence about Dante Wright's phone call with his mother while he was being pulled over. It seemed that the police could get down to a detail like a hanging air freshener over his driver, his rearview mirror, as a cause, a quoted cause, a cited cause for pulling the young man over. But that's, of course, the kind of knife edge life that you're living, driving while black, the phrase is, and it's a sad and appalling reflection that is indeed the kind of terror that young black men and often young women too are having to live in. And at least we stand the chance now with swift action in the case of the Dante Wright killing. The police officer is immediately arraigned and of course relieved of badge and gun, and that's the next case that we will have to follow. And meanwhile, of course, we're all on edge for the final stages of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the fired police officer in Minneapolis, who's coming to the end of his trial for murder of various kinds, second and third degree murder. In that case, we'll have final statements and directions to the jury on Monday after this weekend, and of course, as I say, everyone on edge for the result.
Yeah, I'm so passionate about this is because about 4 years ago, Jill and I were coming back from New York on a Tuesday afternoon, and I was pulled over on Route 22, and we were going the speed limit. And my car is a white Volkswagen. It's low to the ground. I have real nice wheels on it, and I do have darkened windows. Okay, so the police officer very slowly approached the car, and as I rolled down the electric window, he looked in, and he said, "Oh." So I said, "Can I help you, officer?" He said, "Well, you know, you had these tinted windows, and I couldn't see in, and." Don't worry, just go along. Now, I'm positive if I wasn't an overweight at the time, a 65-year-old white male sitting in the car, I'm positive I would have been harassed in some way. I was, you know, he was looking at the car, figuring who would drive it. And when we pulled away, Jill said to me, what did we get pulled over for? I said, well, they thought we were somebody we weren't. It just struck home then, and that was 3 years ago. We'll leave it alone, but it's there's just so much. This country could be on the edge of a big explosion sooner or later, like happened after Martin Luther King was shot. I mean, it really can turn that way very simply.
Your own experience is very educational, or at the least suggestive. I would hold on to that memory firmly whenever cases come up, and of course tell people about them, yeah. Because as you say, very many white people have no conception of the kind of everyday danger that African Americans feel that they're living their life in.
And we can move on to the shooting at the FedEx facility. I mean, eight killed, several wounded. Another quandary that has been, the can has been kicked down the road now for so long, and there just doesn't seem to be an answer to it. Socially, there is an answer to it. Politically, there is no answer to it.
Sure, and it's interesting that we have a president who is making very consequential steps with just about every statement he makes, but we're still in a position where measures to get a hold of gun violence have actually not necessarily forever, but for the moment, been allowed in this president's agenda to slip in priority. When asked about it in his first and really quite striking full-fledged press conference, striking in the sense that it was a real event and that took matters seriously. It was such a change from what we've kind of gotten used to for the previous 4 years. But when asked about this issue, he said it was all a matter of timing, and then went on swiftly to talk about his upcoming infrastructure proposals. Very important in themselves, yes, of course. But it was a great disappointment to the gun control activists who wanted something much more substantial and much more quickly announced by the president in this dire field of people able to get hold of guns and wreak havoc with them, and all the necessary and common sense steps that you might expect this new administration to take will have to take their turn in the rolling out of legislative and executive action proposals that this presidency will be going into over the next few months, and possibly it may may get back onto the agenda, but for now it's clearly not a priority, though events like Indianapolis may well change that.
And we look at a move that was made by President Biden the other day, which was declaring a firm date for where all troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan, September 11th, and marking the fact that there's been four different presidents since this war started, two Democrats, two Republicans, and he was going to put an end to it. And what I thought was terrific in his announcement is he made it really clear the way we can fight terrorism now is we have bodies of anti-terrorist units that are spread throughout the world in bases. If we need to protect ourselves or we need to respond to terrorism, we have the ability to do it without once again occupying a country, and especially a country like Afghanistan, which has never been a country as most people think countries are. It's been a piece of land that has been split up between warlords for centuries.
Sure. The idea of being able to win a war in Afghanistan has perplexed great powers for an awful long time. Britain and Russia tried in the previous centuries, and it's never been a place that great powers get to achieve and do what they want with, which it was part of what diplomatic writers at the time called the great game of rivalry between Britain and Russia. And every effort at controlling Afghanistan always crumbled into dust. And successive powers, too. The Soviet Union in the late 20th century had its own war. For many Russians, the way that they got clogged down in the mire of Afghanistan militarily had a great similarity to the Americans in Vietnam. So yes, many countries have tried, and every major country has failed. And it was only a matter of time, of course, when the truth would be recognized that you can't win in Afghanistan, and that America would eventually withdraw. It's fallen to Biden to be the one who's saying no troops at all after a certain date, and of course he's picked the evocative date of September 11th, exactly 20 years since the terrorist attack which provoked the invasion of Afghanistan in the first place. Now, how you leave the country, whether the country is going to come to any peaceful arrangement within its own ranks, is a matter that clearly America wants to encourage, but cannot possibly hope in any serious way to succeed there either. It's been interesting to see the journalistic efforts this week to predict how what the chances might be of a peace agreement between the Taliban and the Afghan government now. A resounding conclusion from most people is that it's very, very unlikely. So the sadness of it all, of course, is that after 20 years of blood and treasure lost on all sides, we'll find that no great gain was made out of the Afghan invasion for America, and very little for the Afghanis themselves, too. The number of people killed in Afghanistan, of course, is horrific. Many, many more than the sizable number of Americans who were killed there, and of course the costs in other terms too have been excessive. 20-year war is something that no one could be proud of, and the aftermath promises to be very very negative. I've read no analyses that make a strong case, or any case of any kind, for the chances that Afghanistan will be a peaceful and settled country in the wake of America's departure. That's just a fact of modern life now. You can perhaps control the excesses, as you say, by all sorts of other means, particularly in the sophisticated realm of cyber warfare, and you can be much more flexible in the availability of your troops to take swift action if they're needed by a quick in and out action, perhaps based outside the country if it's needed. But all of that lies in a very murky future, and the chances of Afghan ever being a settled country, and of course whether it observes human rights to any reasonable degree, has to remain in severe doubt.
And before we go, I mean, life in England without the Queen's partner. I mean, the BBC got themselves in some serious public criticism for their coverage of the handling of the death.
The BBC can't seem to win. Of course, the matter of the royal family is always contentious, and how you cover their lives, and of course now their death amongst them is always a matter of great sensitivity for the BBC. As I've often said on in this slot, I haven't worked for the BBC very much, just some overseas work for them, but I was always in a different realm of British broadcasting, commercial broadcasting in Britain, although I work for public television now in this country. And the BBC's public role is one that they take very seriously, but it's a difficult thing in which to get the balance correct. They are a very broad-ranging broadcasting outlet, and one of the things that they got themselves in trouble with in this in the wake of Prince Philip's death was to displace a very popular program with a tribute to Prince Philip. Now, a lot of the time, the complaints the BBC has gotten has been about not showing enough respect to the royal family when some royal event happens, particularly a sad royal event like a death. But in this case, there was criticism of them for displacing a popular program with a tribute to the late consort of the Queen. So, as I say, it's a situation where the BBC just can't win.
Now, one final thing, and I want your opinion on this, and this scares me a little bit, and that is Simon & Schuster has decided they will not distribute a book by the Louisville police officer who was involved in the Breonna Taylor raid. I don't know why, if they decided that, why they got into negotiations to do the book. It's a scary sign when you can't get a book published because of your background. I mean, freedom of the press is freedom of the press, and the freedom and the ability to express one. And I know that Simon & Schuster is a big company, and I know that, but this is a black eye for me when you talk about free press.
Sure, they're perfectly at liberty to publish whatever they want and promote any author that they want. It doesn't look like a very sensible set of decisions were taken. I mean, to enter into the field at all is a questionable step. It's not, of course, illegal. It's not. It's something that you can argue about. The very fact that I mean, they also have the right to change their minds, of course, too. I mean, the fact that they did change their minds is very telling. And yes, I mean, in a broad principle, it's disturbing that they should be susceptible to pressure and to drop a proposal to produce something. That always makes any journalist's nerves sort of crackle a little bit. At the thought of something that was planned for publication is dropped. I mean, the word censorship comes to our lips very readily, and we don't like it. But on the other hand, was it a sound decision to court the attention of this particular author? And is it sensible to publish it? Is it commonsensical to publish that kind of work anyway? I'm not saying that it shouldn't be anyone's right to tell their own story, but there are other ways of doing it, and it certainly doesn't have to fall to a very large and previously very reputable publisher to go down that road.
As we wrap up, I'm going to give you a quote, get your reaction to it. Dante Wright's mother. Here's the quote, and it could be the quote of the year, if not the quote of the decade. Quote, justice isn't even a word to me, end quote.
Sure. What she was saying, of course, was a very clear and heartrending statement about the fact that her 19-year-old son is in no way, his memory, his very being, will not be served by anything that the justice system can come up with. That's simply a fact for the mother of a dead boy, and there's no getting away from it. But justice must be served. The wider society needs steps to be taken, not just in the individual case of Daunte Wright, and that we hope will be handled properly and fully with due process in a court of law. But in the wider sense of, making sure that terrible events like this stop happening. America is cursed with this bane of gun violence and police murdering. It's been classed as a murder in many cases, and rightly so, murdering young black individuals. And it simply has to stop.
On that note, we will stop. David, we'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, David is a PBS television correspondent. He reports on ethics and belief. His own website is themediabeat.us, and you can also find him at robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.